For those of you who don't know Shauna, Shauna is a senior lecturer at Macquarie University. In her prior life, she's worked in life insurance, banking and superannuation, so she's had fairly wide experience. And she's been about 15 years, I think, at Macquarie University, where, in fact, I know her quite well from some of our dealings, reviewing passes for exemptions, at least for students in Part 2. Shauna has a great interest in prudential regulation and solvency matters, and indeed wrote the solvency section of the Actuarial Control Cycle textbook. And her interest in this extends to having written quite a number of case studies for those courses and elsewhere, based on real-life experiences, in the belief, I think, that it's very interesting, and secondly, it seems to make a lot of sense to try and at least learn from other people's experiences. So a warm welcome to Shauna, and I'm going to pass over to her to explain to you what this teaser of a question was all about. Thanks, Shauna. Welcome.
Okay. Today I'm going to be talking about the other subprime debt crisis, Australia's home fund scheme, which some of you may be old enough to remember. And today's the theme of our present the forum is financial innovation. But this topic is about the fact that there is very little innovation when you look at financial disasters. When we look at collapses, we find that people just keep making the same mistakes over and over and over again. They just keep repeating the same old mistakes, and it's actually quite difficult to find a new way to lose money. So maybe this is just a sign that I'm getting a bit old, but every time there's another story come out in the newspaper, I think, oh, that's just like something I've seen before, like when Societe Generale announced their losses. I thought, well, you know, I've seen that before. That was Barings and the National Australia Bank and Allied Irish. They all did the same sort of stuff. And when FinCorp started selling a whole bunch of unsecured debentures to pensioners by telling them it was a nice, safe investment, I thought, well, that's a lot like a state mortgage back in the 1980s. And when I saw the subprime lending crisis, I thought, well, that's a lot like that home fund scheme that the New South Wales government ran back in the 1990s. And put ACST 101 there in brackets. That's because in one of our first year actuarial courses, ACST 101, we actually teach students not to design products that have sharp increases in repayments at regular intervals and market them to low-income people because it's a very bad, dangerous product design. And I thought, well, that's exactly what thousands and thousands of people did in the United States. So first of all, I'm just going to explain some of the common features between the subprime debt market collapse and the old home fund scheme. The home fund scheme was specially targeted at lending to people who were on very low incomes, people who would not normally be able to get a home loan from a bank on commercial terms. Home fund was supported by the New South Wales government. In the United States, we saw the subprime debt market was promoted by the U.S. government because Congress was putting pressure on Fannie Mae to make more financing available to low-income people. Well, the New South Wales government strongly supported home fund and provided guarantees. Both types of lending were strongly promoted by investment banks, and we'll see that Salomon Brothers was a key player in the home fund disaster. Both home fund and the subprime debt market were largely financed by securitization. In fact, home fund was the first securitization of a home loan portfolio in Australia back in 1987. It was the first debt issue that was tranched like CDOs so that there were different levels of debt. Home fund and the subprime debt market both have the same product design. products are they're called low start loans, which is a bit of an advertising gimmick. What they should be called is escalating repayment loans. That would be more honest. payments where borrowers start with low repayments so that they can maximize the amount of money that they can borrow and get into as much debt as possible, followed by repayments that jump up quite sharply at regular intervals, creating a repayment shock so that people suddenly discover that they can't afford to make repayments anymore. Financial risk modelling. Well, we know in the subprime debt crisis there's been quite a lot of criticism of the debt rating agencies for doing rather poor modelling of the risks that were underlying those securitised CDOs. And we'll see that the financial risk modelling for Home Fund was in fact quite abysmal. In both cases, the risk, the default risk, gets transferred to a third party. In the subprime debt market, it got transferred to any unsuspecting investors, including, unfortunately, some of our local councils who may have lacked investment expertise. In Home Fund, the risks were ultimately borne by the New South Wales government, and, of course, that means the taxpayers of New South Wales. In both cases, there was an enormous amount of mismarketing risk, which was very poorly managed. Both the subprime debt market and Home Fund grew rapidly. Home Fund was amazingly successful. In just 6 years, they issued 57,000 loans. At one stage, the Home Fund scheme had 18% of the New South Wales home loan market. They were bigger than the Advance Bank and the State Bank of New South Wales combined. So they were very successful, if you measure success by how rapidly you grow. Unfortunately, it was followed by huge losses as there were economic changes. I don't think we will ever know how much the Home Fund scheme cost New South Wales taxpayers. The New South Wales government admitted to $400 million, which, considering that the total amount lent was only $4.3 billion, that's a pretty significant sort of level of loss. I think the losses were actually a bit bigger than that, but there was some interesting accounting in the Home Fund scheme. Of course, once things started to go wrong, the people who lent the money start to try to minimise their losses, and one way to minimise the losses is to put the borrowers under as much pressure as possible, and in some cases even trample on the borrower's rights, and making their life even more miserable. So, in fact, a scheme that starts off by being well-intentioned and helping low-income people ends up persecuting them in a way to make their life more miserable. At this stage, the government decides to intervene to protect the low-income borrowers who are being evicted from their homes, but, of course, the people who lent them the money tend to resist efforts to help out the borrowers if it's going to cost them any money. In the end, of course, everyone sues everyone else, claiming to be misrepresented, misled, deceived, and we end up making lots of money for the legal profession as everyone sues everyone else. And eventually we have flow-on effects to the wider economy. After the collapse of Home Fund, there were suggestions that New South Wales AAA credit rating was on the line, and, of course, there was the collapse in the housing market that we've already seen in the subprime debt market. So there are a lot of similarities. Now, before we start, I'm going to just ask, is lending to low-income borrowers really a good idea for them, for the borrowers, and for the lenders? So I know there are some lending schemes for low-income earners that have been pretty successful. So some of you have heard about the Grameen Bank, which specializes in lending to the poorest of the poor, in microcredit programs, making small loans. And the money is lent to people who want to start a business, which might be buying some chickens or a goat. They've got very unorthodox credit risk management. It's not based on your amount of your collateral or your income. Based on whether they think your business plan is viable. And that kind of lending does have a positive impact on the borrowers, but it's non-profit. So some kinds of lending to the poor do seem to work out pretty well for both the borrowers and the lenders. But let's look at commercial lending. So I want you to think about this. Suppose, for example, that you are marketing credit cards which have a 0% interest rate for 6 months, followed by a 20% interest rate thereafter. Who is your ideal customer? Who would you want to issue one of these credit cards to? 0% for the first 6 months and 20% thereafter.
We don't want those to repay.
Right, okay, we don't want the rich people because they're going to take the 0% for the 6 months and then they're going to repay their loan and you're going to lose money on them. So we don't want anyone who's up the top end of the scale that's very rich. Even if they can refinance at a lower interest rate, they're not going to pay you the
20%. You don't want anyone at the other end.
You don't want very poor people because they're going to default and you're going to make a loss from defaulting, right? So you kind of want people who are somewhere in the middle, not too well off, not too poor. Your ideal customer is someone who will borrow a lot of money, be constantly in debt, unable to refinance at lower rates, but never quite going over the line to defaulting, right? That seems logical. Now suppose that you find someone who will take the default risk for you, possibly some government agency that will guarantee that they'll cover the default risk. That would be Fannie Mae in the US. Or in the case of Home Fund, it's the New South Wales government. In many cases in the subprime market, it was whichever investor was willing to buy the toxic waste tranche of your CDOs, the high-risk tranche that would bear the losses first. Okay, what impact would that have on your marketing strategy? Who would you want to target now? You want to move down the scale, don't you? There's the people at the very bottom end who are really poor. They're now ideal customers. They're people who will borrow a lot of money. They'll probably borrow as much as you're willing to lend them. They'll never be able to refinance. They won't be able to pay off the debt. As long as they stay above the water, you'll make your 20%. And if they go under, who cares? You, somebody else is going to pick up the loss. So is this kind of lending likely to have positive outcomes for the people who are borrowing the money?
Possibly.
Well, why not? Why shouldn't those poor people have access to all those things that they really have their heart set on? And it's up to them to decide for themselves if they want to get themselves into debt and pay 20% interest.
I think in the US, after 2 years, your credit rating gets wiped.
Oh, so you can start again. Okay. So a question I want to ask is, when does lending to the poor become predatory lending? Maybe never. After all, they chose to borrow. It's their right to borrow money if they want to. It's their decision. Why shouldn't they be allowed to borrow? But is there something that would actually make it predatory lending? I notice there's now an Australian organisation to oppose predatory lending. What makes lending predatory?
Salespeople.
I think that's a good answer. Explain more. Okay, so control of mismarketing risk would be really important to avoid predatory lending, making sure that the people who take out the loan really understand what they're getting into. So when you think about the subprime lending crisis in the US, do you think, well, most of those people, they don't deserve much sympathy because after all they took out the home loan, they knew the interest rates were high? Or do you think there was possibly some mismarketing going on? I know this is a controversial topic at the moment.
That's not the information they got, didn't they? borrowed.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll look at the home fund scheme, and I think the problem with the home fund scheme is it started off as a government program which was supposed to help low-income people to buy their own homes, but it all went terribly wrong. And one of the things where one of the ways it went terribly wrong is that as time went by and they built up more, there was a lot of what I would call predatory lending. There was a lot of mismarketing, and a lot of the people who the program was supposed to help actually ended up being a lot worse off and probably rued the day that they ever got involved with the New South Wales government's lending scheme. Of course, after it all went wrong, there were heaps and heaps of reports. There was a report by the Trade Practices Commissioner, which criticised Home Fund. There was a New South Wales Auditor General report, which criticised the financial management of Home Fund. There was a report by the Ombudsman, which I have not been able to read because the government refused to release it. Apparently it was so negative they didn't want the publicity. I think a copy did fall off the back of a truck somewhere near the Sydney Morning Herald office block because there are some quotes that appeared in the Sydney Morning Herald. The government had a special inquiry from a guy called Mr. McMurtry, who was an investment banker from UBS, and he obviously became an expert in subprime lending, and unfortunately doesn't seem to have passed his experiences on to his employer. Perhaps he's retired by now. And there was a parliamentary investigation led by John Hatton, which resulted in a 700-and-something page report, and there was also a special Home Fund commissioner who reported on complaints about the Home Fund scheme. Most of these reports are now gathering dust somewhere in the State Library and are not generally available, but I think what we can learn from them was quite interesting. So I'm going to run through a quick summary of what happened. Securitisation of home mortgages really started with Salomon Brothers in the United States. Those of you who've read Larry's Poker, which is a great book, will know the story. They set up a mortgage trading desk in 1979, which at first was remarkably unsuccessful. Nobody seemed to want to securitise residential mortgages, and nobody seemed to want to buy them. But it changed in 1981 when there was the savings and loan crisis. Savings and loan was known as a 363 business. You borrow at 3%, lend at 6%, and go to the golf course by 3 o'clock in the afternoon. That was a very peaceful business to be in. But as interest rates shot through the roof, it became a 9-6-3 business. You borrowed at 9% and lent at 6% and had a 3% loss on every dollar that you lent out. So the government became quite concerned by the fact that savings and loans were going out the door backwards quite rapidly. So they came up with this plan to change savings and loans into being a 9-12-3 business. They said, get out of that home lending business where you can just earn money at 6%. Change your investments so that you invest in a lot of high-return investments, and that's the only way you'll survive if you get out of home lending and into property development and junk bonds. This strategy did not actually turn out too well for the savings and loan industry because they did just what they were told and invested in property development and junk bonds and then went broke anyway. But as part of the plan, the government gave great tax incentives to persuade savings and loans to sell out their residential mortgage portfolios and switch to different asset allocation. So the savings and loans became desperate sellers, very keen to get rid of their residential mortgage portfolios. At first, and Salomon Brothers was in the box seat, they were willing to buy all these residential mortgages, package them up and sell them to other people. But they couldn't find anyone to buy the mortgages because of the credit risk. So Salomon Brothers persuaded the government that they should bear the credit risk to help develop the secondary mortgage market. And that's when Fannie Mae really began to become the underwriter for CDOs. The Salomon Trading Desk made a fortune and became the heroes of Wall Street. For the next few years, they made millions and millions and millions of dollars. And obviously, someone at Salomon Brothers said, gee, I wonder if this would work in any other countries. At this stage, someone in Salomon Brothers came to New South Wales and started talking to Mr. Rann, who was the Premier at the time, and Mr. Allen, who was the head of Treasury. And they started trying to convince everyone that a secondary mortgage market would be a really, really good idea. And this is Frank Walker, who was the Minister for Housing, said there was a very strong push. Every conference he went to, someone was saying, we need a secondary mortgage market. The Treasury was in favour of this because they said, we want Sydney to be the financial capital of Asia. We need to have strong financial markets. So at every conference, there was someone there from Salomon Brothers saying, let's have a secondary mortgage market. And of course, some of you who are old enough can remember in the 1980s, it was quite fashionable for governments to intervene in the state economy to try and encourage development. You might remember some of the experiments in the 1980s in this area. Does anyone remember what kind of projects got underway? You probably do, Trevor. It's the State Bank of Victoria, the State Bank of South Australia, and too many institutions to think of in WA, where the state governments encouraged lots of lending for development and intervention in the financial markets. Most of these did not turn out really, really well. And I'm afraid that a home fund scheme was similar. FANMAC got set up by the New South Wales government, the first Australian National Mortgage Acceptance Corporation in 1984. The New South Wales government owned 26% and a bunch of other financial institutions owned the rest. Salomon Brothers owned 5%. The chairman was the managing director of Salomon Brothers in Australia, who had a lot of expertise in securitisation. And Salomon managed the first bond issue. So the objective of FANMAC was to establish a secondary mortgage market among commercial lenders, but this never really took off. Nobody seemed to be very interested, and I think the Reserve Bank didn't encourage banks to do this. They were a bit worried about the securitisation risks. So they had to have a change of plans. Where can we find another portfolio of home loans to securitise? So, luckily, as usual, New South Wales was having a housing crisis, so what else is new? Housing was unaffordable. There were long waiting lists for public housing. The number of people on the waiting list had gone up by 10%. People were waiting for 2 years to get into a home. Nothing's really changed that much. So you might think, why didn't the New South Wales borrow to build more public housing or subsidise home purchases? Well, the answer was because they weren't allowed to. States weren't allowed to borrow as much as they wanted. There were global borrowing limits that limited the amount that they could borrow. So luckily, that's what merchant banks are for. If there's some constraint on your business, they will help you find a way around it. So lots of financial wizards were travelling around the state governments, telling them that they could help them raise money that wouldn't appear in the state budget anywhere. And that's exactly what FANMAC became. It was an off-balance sheet way for the New South Wales government to obtain funding for housing. FANMAC would issue bonds, they'd lend the money to low-income borrowers, and the government would guarantee the repayment of the bonds. When the first proposal came out, they said, this guarantee against the default risk will only have a nominal cost to the government. Famous last words category. And the New South Wales government proudly announced this wonderful, innovative new scheme to use capital markets to meet social objectives. So the structure was that they would set up a trust, the FANMAC trust, bonds to the bondholders, lend money to the borrowers. FANMAC would manage the trusts. The Department of Housing over there would funnel money into the trust to provide guarantees through the Home Purchase Assistance Fund. Now, the Auditor General wasn't very happy about this. Why do you think the Auditor General wasn't very happy? Any suggestions? If you were the Auditor General, would you be happy?
Yeah.
What's the problem here? They've accepted a lot of risk, and it's not going to show up anywhere in the New South Wales state government accounts. The Auditor General felt, I think quite reasonably, that if the New South Wales government was providing the guarantees and accepting the financial risks and effectively controlling the Home Fund program, that this should show up somewhere in the state government accounts. But the government didn't agree. I mean, the whole reason we were setting up this scheme was to bypass the Loan Council restrictions. We didn't want it to come up on the balance sheet, right? So this is... the Auditor General he expressed his view strongly that this was an evasion of financial responsibility, and since the government's liabilities were not shown in any government accounts, the usual financial controls were not in place, and the Home Fund program really got completely out of control. There's no effective supervision, no effective risk management, no accountability at all for the potential amounts of money that they were putting at risk here.
And the Auditor General identified this
quote for? Well, the Auditor General's report, no. I think these quotes come from a report in 1991. I don't know how, if anyone even asked him when it was first set up. So I think this is a problem that is still evident in our financial markets and our banking system for our prudential regulators. Now, our banks securitize their mortgage portfolios, they pass them off to SPVs, and supposedly the risk is all moved off to an SPV, and then the parent company doesn't have any risk. The parent company doesn't have to set aside any capital. This has been very evident in the subprime market in the US. You get big companies like Bear Stearns, which own a hedge fund subsidiary. They claim that the hedge fund is completely separate from them. They don't have any liability to the hedge fund. But as soon as the hedge fund gets into trouble, Bear Stearns suffers the reputational risk, and they end up taking the hedge fund back onto their books. And those risks, which were supposedly transferred away, are accepted back into the parent company. And you can see this has been a factor in some of the big investment banks going broke in the subprime debt crisis, because they take back those risks which supposedly have been swept under the carpet. Now, APRA, for example, says if banks do have SPVs and transfer all their risks off to the SPV, that's okay as long as it's a clean securitization. So I guess Home Fund was the Australian leader in developing dirty securitizations, where the risk apparently disappeared off the books but was really still there. The next part of the proposal was actually setting up the scheme. The New South Wales government said, well, you guys are the experts at FANMAC, why don't you set up the product design and all the legal documentation, controlling the trust funds and so on. The Hatton Inquiry found that FANMAC, not surprisingly, drafted all the agreements to be to the benefit of FANMAC rather than to the benefit of the New South Wales government. A legal consultant who was asked to review the documents later said basically the system was set up so that all of the legal risks of the transactions were passed to the state by one means or another, but the state had no means of controlling any of those risks, even where the risks were arising from FANMAC failing to meet its obligations under the contract. So if somebody else is drafting the deal which allocates the risks, I think as a buyer of that, buyer into that deal, you need to read the documents really, really carefully. FANMAC, of course, was paid by commission. Once the risks were transferred to the New South Wales government, really, there was a pretty strong incentive for FANMAC to maximise the amount of money that was lent out. A subsequent review found that the program was constantly evolving, but all the evolution of the program seemed to be about lending more money to more people with less stringent requirements. There's an old saying, after you shake hands with a merchant banker, you should count your fingers. And I think that was applicable in this case. Over the next few years, the New South Wales government lost hundreds of millions of dollars. Many of the borrowers were financially ruined, evicted from their homes with huge debts. Fernmac, on the other hand, did really quite well out of the whole thing, achieving returns on equity exceeding 85%. And this became somewhat controversial in the newspapers when they saw that Fernmac was making so much money while creating mayhem in the financial system. The home fund sold a lot of low-start loans. The basic features were the same as the adjustable-rate mortgages they have in the U.S. Repayments escalated at 6% per annum. Some of the other banks were selling what they call these stepped loans or low-start loans, but the escalation factor was usually 1% or 2%, and they were selling them to professionals. They were having 6% per annum repayment escalation for people who were on the lowest income levels. The interest rates were fixed for the term of the loan, and at the time they were being marketed, interest rates were started at 15%, went up to 15.9% shortly afterwards. There were no prepayment penalties. This became an important risk factor. So this turned out to be quite disastrous. The 6% escalating repayments meant they could maximize the amount of money lent out to the borrowers, which was reasonable because houses in Sydney are expensive. But as people quickly realized, if the borrower's income didn't increase by at least 6% per annum, then it would become increasingly difficult for these borrowers to repay, a feature that's now called repayment shock. And this was obvious at the time the program was designed. The cooperative building societies, housing societies, which were marketing the loans, said, this is really dangerous. And the Sydney Morning Herald ran a few expose-type articles saying, this is really dangerous. But the Department of Housing said, don't worry. Average weekly earnings have historically always increased by 6%, so, there's nothing to worry about, which turned out to be not quite right. They were right. Average weekly earnings were above 6% right through the early 1980s and through most of the 70s. This, of course, is about when most of the home fund loans were marketed, 1989, 88, 89, 90, and you can see that for the next 10 years, average earnings never reached 6% in any year for the next decade. So perhaps that was a bit optimistic. My question is, was this foreseeable? I mean, should the people designing this project have had some inkling that this might happen?
If you're an actuary, yes.
If you're an actuary, you would think about the possibility that it might happen. Now, those of you who are too young to remember might have heard of something called the Accord. Back in the early 1980s, the 1983, the Labor government got elected, and one of their policy platforms was control of wages to make sure that wage increases would stay at or near the rate of inflation. So it was government policy to reduce wages, and they had a deal with the unions to try and control wages. So I think if you actually read the newspapers, it possibly should have occurred to you maybe that wages might not stay at 6% for so long. Unemployment rates during the early 90s were steadily rising, hit almost 12%. So by 1993, 11% of the home fund borrowers were in arrears by at least 2 months and were in danger of losing their homes. And even worse, of course, they would be homeless and deeply in debt because of the negative equity feature of escalating repayments. If you take out a $100,000 loan, the amount owing will steadily increase for about the first 10 or 12 years. And that's okay, as long as house prices were rising. If house prices rose at the appropriate rates, then the homeowner would retain positive equity. But, of course, if house prices didn't increase, then we'd have a problem. Once again, all the loans were made basically between 1988 and 1990, and you can see that home price increases completely flattened out as soon as all the home fund loans were made. So borrowers who were forced to sell their homes usually had to sell at a loss, and they were left homeless and with large debts for the balance of the loan. Was this foreseeable? Was it foreseeable that home prices would flatten out I mean, historically, Sydney home prices keep going up and up and up. Can't you just count on historical trends continuing? Yeah, so people who have some knowledge of housing cycles might realize that after a big increase, maybe things will flatten out a bit. And what controls demand for housing? What's the biggest factor that... Supply of home loans, and in particular the interest rate. Okay, during those years, the interest rate on home loans went from 13.5% to 17%. Do you think that might have some impact on the demand for housing? Gee, I don't know. fixed interest rates. These loans, most Australian home loans have variable rates, but in the US they have fixed rates. Salomon Brothers decided that bond buyers liked fixed rate loans, so if they were going to sell fixed rate loans, the home loan funds had to have fixed interest rates. At the start, they were 15%, later went up to 15.9%. Okay, is this kind of loan design good for the borrowers? Yeah? They're protected from the risk of future interest rate increases. It looked cheap in the first year. The fixed rates were 0.5% below the variable rates. But can you see any potential problems coming up here? Do you think if interest rates are 15.9%, are they more likely to go up or down over the next few years? Sorry? Okay, good point. If the interest rate goes up, couldn't they just repay their loan and refinance at a lower rate? That's what they do in the U.S. Who's going to lend to these guys? by 1993, the home loan rates were below 10%. You can see most of the loans were made. So naturally, you'd first think, couldn't these guys refinance? Well, they couldn't because they were the people that nobody would lend money to start with. They were the low-income borrowers. And anyway, they had negative equity by now. The amount of their loan was way more than the value of their house. So who's going to lend them any money? Some people did refinance. Quite a lot of the home fund borrowers, about maybe half the home fund borrowers, well, a bit less than half, 30 or 40% of the home fund borrowers did refinance as soon as they got a chance. But the rest of them were completely locked in.
What did they make refinance? They already got the problem.
Sorry?
That
was considered. We'll get to that in a minute. That was considered, but what would be the problem with doing that? That's the trouble. The debt was set up so that the government covered the default risk, but not the prepayment risk. So by 1993, when Home Fund was closed down, the default rates were up, the foreclosures were increasing, and the people who were left, the poorest people in the community, were paying the highest interest rates in the state, which looked really bad when people said things like that in Parliament. You know, excuse me, Mr. Griner, isn't it true that the home fund borrowers are paying 15.9% when everyone else is paying 10%? Is this a good outcome? So it's difficult to argue that this was a good outcome for the borrowers. Okay, this is where we're going to have a slight digression into alternative realities. Thanks. When something goes wrong, there are usually two versions of reality. There's the official version and the conspiracy theory version. For example, when JFK was shot, the official version was it was Lee Harvey Oswald. The other version was that there was someone on the grassy knoll who was hired by the CIA or something. When the 9/11 disaster happened, there was the official theory, which was that it was Osama bin Laden, and there was the conspiracy theory, which was that it was the CIA. Now, basically, I'm the kind of person who usually believes the official theory. Sometimes the official version requires you to believe that someone is incompetent rather than immoral. For example, with the Australian Wheat Board, we were asked to believe that the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade really had no idea what was going on, and they had no idea that any Australian organisation was paying any kind of kickbacks to Iraq. So they wanted us to believe that they were incompetent instead of immoral. With Iraq, the question was, did the US government really believe that there were weapons of mass destruction, Or were they just saying that to justify what they wanted to do anyway? So I'm a fairly trusting person. I usually believe the official explanation, but I can see there are some arguments on the other side. Now let's apply this to Home Fund. Home Fund was clearly a disaster for the borrowers. So was this incompetence, or was it designed this way? Well, there's a theory that says whenever it's a choice between incompetence and iniquity, you should always believe incompetence, because incompetence is pretty common. And it's the most probable explanation. So the question was this stupidity or iniquity? And the answer that I saw someone post on the internet was, these two explanations need not be mutually exclusive. A lot of the reviews afterwards said there was no evidence that anyone considered the possibility that the economic assumptions would be incorrect. And the Department of Housing was criticized because basically it seemed like they never really thought about it. On the other hand, when you read the transcripts of the investigations more carefully, we can see that there was a prepayment risk issue here. The bonds that were issued on a pass-through basis, which means that bondholders would be guaranteed of a high interest rate until the home loans were repaid. If interest rates fell and people refinanced with the bank at the lower interest rate, then the loans would terminate early, and the bondholders would be paid out, and they would have to reinvest the money at the lower interest rates. So basically, the bondholders were bearing the prepayment risk, and they would like the risk of prepayments to be minimized. That makes sense? By a lucky coincidence, the product design ensured that the risk of prepayments was likely to be quite low. Well, was that just a coincidence? When they talked to the bond underwriters afterwards, they said that when they were valuing the bonds, the investors who bought the bonds had to make an informed judgment about the ability to prepay, and they decided that the home fund borrowers would have very limited ability to prepay, and that would make the bonds more valuable, and they'd be willing to pay a higher price for them. And the conclusion from the Hatton Inquiry was one of the main reasons why the securities were so attractive initially was because the supporting mortgages were trapping the borrowers. And the Auditor General in his report also said that the product seemed to be designed this way.
Is that like, sorry, did you argue in that the involved in morality then, the buyer of the bonds?
I think if the people who realized that the product that they were selling was going to be detrimental to the borrowers while they were purporting to be helping them and they didn't inform them of the risks. I'm not saying it was the bondholders' fault. They were making a commercial decision. It was the New South Wales government, which was responsible for designing this product, that had to balance the interests of the bondholders with the interests of the borrowers. Now, if they knew that this product was going to be likely to be detrimental to the borrowers, I'd have to say that I think that would be ethically undesirable. Yeah, on the government's point of view, if they realised that that was what was happening.
Is there any evidence that they were aware of this?
Well, the Auditor General said that it was, in his report, said that it was designed this way.
What the bond sellers say to the potential buyers may be completely different.
Oh, you mean what Fanmac said to the what the underwriters said to the people who were buying the bonds? They gave them some advice about prepayment risk. I don't know. I haven't seen exactly what was in there. There was a lot of it was the first time one of these products had been sold in Australia, and apparently there was a lot of concern about the prepayment risk. They were giving the buyers advice based on the US experience, which turned out to be not very applicable to the Australian market. The next problem was, of course, that meant that there was a vested interest in preventing anyone from prepaying because this would upset the bondholders. So when it came to... I'm sorry, we're almost out of time. When it came to provisions for allowing people to refinance, these were blocked. Initially, when the product was proposed, Questions were raised in Parliament and in the newspapers about the possibility that borrowers would get locked into these high interest rate loans. The Department of Housing issued brochures and press statements repeatedly promising that there would be a refinancing option available for anyone who got into trouble. But in practice, it never actually happened. And in fact, the mortgage documents, the deal between FNMAC and the New South Wales government forbade any internal refinancing. That is that they couldn't refinance anyone who was already in the program into a cheaper loan. Because, and it says quite specifically, we can't do this because that would upset the bondholders because it would increase the prepayment risk. When things started to go sour, the New South Wales government issued a press release saying that they would give a $5,000 grant to anyone who wanted to refinance who needed the grant to overcome their negative equity problem. This proposal lasted for just a few days before the bond underwriters protested, claiming that this was increasing the prepayment risk, and they claimed $25 million compensation from the New South Wales government for their losses, so the proposal to offer a refinancing grant disappeared after just a few days. So you can see here there's a conflict between the commercial needs of the lending program and the needs of the borrowers, and I'm afraid the borrowers often came off second best in balancing these needs. I mean, the program couldn't have existed unless the money was raised, that's true. But if you're selling people a product which is going to be likely to have a high probability of leading to them being financially ruined, maybe we need to think about that before we sell the product. I'll skip over the next section. There was another type of loan which was also a difficulty. And once again, basically, I'd have to say that the New South Wales government acted in a way which was extremely detrimental to the borrowers. They, once the cost of the loan started blowing out, the government took steps to force the borrowers to repay more money than they were legally required to pay, and the borrowers were not in a position to argue against New South Wales government department. I'll skip over that, but it's very interesting. Mr. Hatton, in his review, said he had two choices. The committee could either conclude that the senior management of FNMAC and the Department of Housing were simply incompetent, or that the senior management of FNMAC and the Department of Housing knew exactly what the terms of the loan were and decided to flaunt its provisions. Basically, the rules of the loan said borrowers could reduce their repayments if they got into financial difficulties, if their income dropped. But the Department of Housing issued guidelines to all the loan administrators telling them that they were not to allow the repayment reductions that were specified in the mortgage documents. The Department of Housing said that it was all a terrible mistake. However, testimony at the inquiry said staff who were being trained about these repayment reductions were told the people that make a noise adjust their repayments back to 27% of income, which was the contractual requirement. For everyone else, just use the formula that we've given you, which was to not allow repayments. Although the Department of Housing claimed that they were confused about their rules, the Hatton Inquiry noted that in all their advertising material they had the correct rules, but in the guidelines for administering the repayment reductions, the rules were incorrect. I said, well, this is a strange kind of confusion that only appears after people have already signed up for the loans. Somebody queried this rule when the product was designed and they were told that the clause had to go in, allowing the repayment reductions, but they didn't actually intend to implement it because it would be too expensive. Now, when we get to remember what I said at the beginning about predatory lending and how easy it would be to have a low-income lending scheme that might veer towards predatory lending. Well, when I read this kind of stuff, I thought, I think we've gone over the line here. After the error was discovered, after it was publicised in the Sydney Morning Herald, the Department of Housing made retrospective adjustments to payments for more than 1,300 borrowers. And about 20% of the subsidized borrowers went on to repayment reductions, which cost the government a lot of money. Financial controls, basically, the government needed a good financial model to control its level of risk. The model that they used had numerous errors. No one at the Department of Housing actually understood the model. And even worse, the model assumptions were manipulated to give the government the answers they wanted to hear. When the government said, we want to increase the lending program, they just cut the default assumption in half for the input to the model. I'm sure this would never happen in any company that any of us ever worked for. Even when the model came up with answers saying the program should not be expanded, the government expanded it anyway. This was under Nick Briner's premiership. The Treasury was recommending a maximum of $200 million. That is about here. And as you can see, the amount of lending increased out of sight. Marketing was by a cooperative building societies who worked closely with real estate agents and property developers. I don't think I need to tell you what happened next. The real estate agents and property developers strongly supported Home Fund. It allowed them to sell a lot more homes, and they basically acted as agents for the Home Fund Society. The cooperative building societies, which were marketing the products, were paid by commission, and there were virtually no controls to prevent them from mismarketing. In the end, the Trade Practices Commission had an inquiry into unconscionable conduct by Home Fund, and they issued a completely damning report which said that many of the borrowers had been deceived about the terms and conditions of their mortgages, and that many people who had previously been public housing tenants were now in a cycle of debt, poverty, and hardship as a result of the Home Fund program. They set up the Home Fund Commissioner to investigate complaints. At the time, there were 26,000 loans outstanding, and they received 8,400 complaints, which is a pretty high level of customer dissatisfaction, I would say. Adding to the cost, and this is where we see the similarity to the subprime crisis, the borrowers got together in a class action and sued the New South Wales government, and eventually, after about 8 years, dragging through the courts, won a settlement of $75 million. So when you do this kind of product that destroys people's lives, I think you should factor in a legal risk component into your costing. If you end up selling products like this, which are detrimental, someone's going to sue you. And we can see that happening in the subprime market as well. The program was ceased in 1993. Some borrowers survived. Maybe half the borrowers refinanced. Many of the others were financially devastated. 5,000 people lost their homes. This is out of a total of 57,000 borrowers, so that's about 10% maybe. The Department of Housing bought their houses and rented them back to them at a reduced rate for various lengths of time. The rest were put on to reduced interest rates, which the New South Wales government subsidised. Total cost to the taxpayers was at least $400 million. That's what they admit to in the accounts. I think it was probably way more than that. When you look at the accounts, there are a lot of really odd sort of things in the accounts, like the New South Wales government bought some zero-coupon irredeemable securities from Fanmac, and they had it as an asset in their balance sheet. The accountant that was hired to look at the account said he thought this really shouldn't be counted as an asset and perhaps should be reclassified as an expense. Anyway, there are a lot of quite peculiar transactions in the accounts. I'd really like an accountant sometime to explain to me what was going on here. My conclusion is that the New South Wales government set up this program supposedly to help low-income borrowers get a home, but in fact, this was really a predatory lending scheme for a lot of the people involved in it. People were misled. Their mismarketing was terrible. Their contractual rights were trampled on. They were put into products which had a very high risk of them getting into trouble, and the products were designed not for their benefit, but for the benefit of the people who were financing it. So we're almost out of time. But I'd just be interested in hearing what you think about this program. I think it was not priced at all, really. Well, the model that the Department of Housing used was supposed to sort of monitor credit risk, but it was such a pathetic model that it was useless, really. And the New South Wales government didn't seem to really care. They were just... It wasn't going to go in their budget. It wasn't going to appear in the accounts. There was no requirement for them to set aside reserves for the credit risk. They just decided to ignore it. They certainly made a lot of decisions where they hugely expanded the program and increased their credit risk without really seeming to go through any kind of consideration of what it was going to cost.
Look, just watching from up here everyone's reactions, that was a fantastically interesting presentation, and I can see why Shauna gets such pleasure out of doing case studies, as I said in her introduction, because there's so many fantastic lessons to be learned and from an enthralling and, to be honest, a distressing story like that. And the frustrating thing for me is that, I'm not going to name them here, but there are products out there in the market today that I believe satisfy all the faults in the criteria that was in that actual example there, and it does beg the question, where are the regulators when it comes to dealing with these products? So can we just say thank you very much to Shauna for a great presentation.